Welcome back, Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. We are here to add some talk sophistication, think sophistication to the world so that you can handle some of the stuff that's coming avalanching down the political mountains these days. And it's a lot. I'm Dr. Dan, rhetoric PhD, escaped professor, turned comedy writer, live in LA, founder of Rhetoric Warriors, and the soon to be developed, hopefully to launch this in 2023, the Ethical Persuasion Institute, where I do some type of activism and education in a more organized way than just the podcast and the book. On the podcast, I talk to comedians about their careers and their politics. I need to do some more of that. I've got a lot of friends out here. I convert conservatives because the right worries me. I think they can use some conversion, bring them back to the fold. And I talk to people who study this stuff and are actively in the world of persuasion and social issues, education. More rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast you'll listen to today. This is my second time with my guest today. Super smart, super fun. She's a professor and Admiral James B. Stockdale Chair. Sounds good. Like when you're the chair of a James D. B. Yeah. Of professional military ethics at the Naval War College. Let's get her on here, Dr. Pauline Shanks-Karin.
Thank you. And just the usual disclaimer that I'm here in my personal capacity and not representing the Naval War College, the Department of Defense, or the Department of the Navy. But thank you for having me back. Evidently, you didn't learn your lesson the first time. So let's see if we can sort that out.
Philosophy is a bigger area than you might, right? Like it's endless. It's just same with rhetoric. It just encompasses everything.
Keeps going.
Yeah. So your area of expertise, one of your many areas of expertise, I looked through your blog again today. So many cool articles and posts in there. Everybody should go check that out. Especially going with the bibliography you're building for all the different levels of very useful. But violence, and you know, you can't have the military without violence, right?
Right.
So we've got that one setting there, and now we have politics coming up, which seems to be more and more, you know, sort of suggesting this civil war, this, you know, January 6th, like there's political violence gurgling. So it's a topic we need to talk about.
Yeah. And I, you know, I taught classes on terrorism. I also taught a class toward the end of my tenure at Pacific Lutheran University to undergrads just on political violence, and it was very early 2018. So that was an interesting class, sort of reflecting back on the 2016 presidential election. But I'm also from Montana, where we have lots of militias and white supremacists groups. The Unabomber was hanging out there in Lincoln for a while in a cabin, the Freeman in Jordan, Montana. So political violence is something I've been interested in, both from the perspective of war, but then also sort of social and political philosophy, and when is political violence justified? Is it ever justified? You know, these, and we talk about these issues, especially January 6th, the War College, because now the military is sort of getting caught in the middle of some of these things and has some members who a minority, obviously, but who espouse various political beliefs, some of which involve violence against certain populations. So this is an issue. It's something that we have to think about. So
you cannot divorce humanity from violence, right? I mean, my side of the world in rhetoric is in some ways you can define it as a form of sort of cognitive or linguistic violence, and that you're trying actively, at least assertiveness, you're assertively trying to bring people from one place to another. So you don't shrink away from the active engagement with the other. Now, when you move that over into, like, I guess we're going to have to do the rhetoric thing to start with. Like, how do you move that over into something that becomes defined as violence versus assertive influence? You know, what is the line that turns it into violence?
Yeah, I guess it depends. Then this is the War College philosopher answer. I guess it depends how you define violence. So there are some people who would argue that certain forms of speech, like hate speech, for example, or speech that denigrates or humiliates or dehumanizes or so on, that those kinds of speech are actually a kind of violence. So there's that position. So it depends. Do you mean that, or do you usually think of like physical kinetic violence? Like I'm, going to like punch someone or shoot someone or try to kill someone or assault someone. I think the where one becomes the other, like the physical violence is pretty easy to see, right? We know what physical violence looks like. January 6th, lots of physical violence going on. Some of the other stuff it's harder to see is a threat to lynch someone and you have a crowd assembled where it's an imminent threat. Is that a kind of violence? And and since you're in rhetoric, I'm really interested in what people think the link is between rhetoric and violence. So someone like John Stuart Mill, who wrote a famous book called On Liberty in the 19th Century, says, listen, government should not limit it, freedom of speech except to prevent imminent physical harm to someone else. That's the only reason the government should intervene. Now, individual citizens can do other things like refuse to talk to people and stuff. But the government should not intervene except to prevent physical violence. And his view was that if you let people spew, if you let them say their stuff, that it was kind of a release valve and you'd be less likely to have physical violence if people could sort of, go off about whatever they wanted to go off on. And then other people would say, no, that's wrong. And, so he, I think, viewed this in terms of what we call the marketplace of ideas. But I know when I've taught Mill the last couple of years at the War College, and even before that, students are pretty skeptical about that argument and wondered, like, how does social media change that? Because now anybody can go off and millions of people can be influenced by what they say, as opposed to like when I was growing up. Like if I went down to the corner and went off, like maybe there's five or six people, most of whom were related to me, who might hear that. But there was a pretty limited, there's a pretty limited scope and influence. So I'm curious about what you see as the link between does rhetoric lead to violence? And especially there's an argument in genocide and Holocaust studies, right? That that genocidal behavior starts with dehumanizing language and certain kinds of rhetoric and referring to people as subhuman or as animals or as insects. And it's that language that starts to set the mindset that then allows it to be easier to engage in physical violence later on. So that would be my question for you. I don't know the answer to that
Well, yeah, I
question.
think it's the classic binary answer, that the safe binary answer of both are absolute truths, right? Staying
Right.
in dialogue with people tends to humanize them,
Right.
and you learn their perspective the closer you get, especially if you're doing deep change on difficult topics. A lot of times it's about praxis and direct experience with that population. Like you can talk forever, but you can't get change unless you can get them actually in deep interaction over time. And then they can understand these are human beings. There's no way to deny that because they've talked so much, right? They've communicated so much. Versus over here, this kind of planned, unethical rhetoric, authoritarian rhetoric, triggering rhetoric, even media, which is designed to heighten
Right.
emotions and situations, it clearly does that. It clearly can take people up to the point where they can no longer process down here in like the real experience of a community. It becomes this fantasy, and once it gets up into there in the sort of big good evil terms, then of course you've got more justification, for violent moral action. So it's both, and I think social media is it's far more over here, right? It's far
The
more.
far is a higher, even though, so like what you're talking about is when you're in dialogue, like philosophical or other kind of dialogue with someone, especially over a period of time. That's kind of one thing, and that can happen on social media. And that we've had, you know, a few cases of where people have really been persuaded to a different view through their sustained interaction with someone else on social media, right? But most of social media is sort of putting the blast out or consuming things where it's not you and I having a conversation. It's me and my followers. Like, I sick my followers on you, and it's abusive. It's not dialogue. I'm not interested in your arguments. It's sort of insulting and bullying and, you know, all those kinds of things, which that seems to remove actually people from each other. So it depersonalizes it in a way, I think, that makes, and I think you have to, for most humans, you have to depersonalize before you can engage in violence, usually, right? Not always. I mean, intimate partner violence is different, you know, sort of honor violence is different. But for most people, like, they won't just kill somebody that they see at the grocery store. Like, some stuff has to happen. And what you're talking about, the, like, me turning you into a non-human, or you are evil, and evil has a lot of power because evil should be eradicated. You don't have a discussion with evil, right? You don't come to compromise with evil, which is, you know, I think American politics has always had some of this because of our religious roots. So, like, you know, our rhetoric has never been like sunshine and roses. Look at the presidential election of 1800 if you want some fun, you know, interesting insult. That was pretty nasty. But I think when the times when that evil discourse comes up, it makes it impossible to compromise. And then it makes it easier to do things that you can't, they're harder to take back. Right? They're harder to reconcile afterwards, right? And that's what we see as a precursor to genocidal behavior. We see that kind of language about evil, or you know, dehumanizing language, or lots of language around, like, this is an infestation. And so, of course, you wouldn't, like, have a dialogue with insects.
Sure.
You get rid of the infestation.
With great vehemence. Yeah.
Right.
You can kill, like, there's nothing, you know, more vehement than killing a fly you haven't had to catch for 20 minutes. I think back to, like, Bush on 9/11, you know, the sort of reactivity to evil, like, when it gets lifted up into story and narrative, right? When it's pure narrativity, and you need good and evil, you need villains and heroes and narratives, and him walking out, you know, with the bullhorn, people will pay for this. We're the best murdering machine that's ever been, and we're going to murder you so hard for what you've just done.
Toby Keith, courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, which came out right after that. I listen to country music, not my favorite song, but it did, unlike some other hokey country music songs from the time. Like, I think that song resonated, especially with, it was very popular with military audiences. He would go and play it for military audiences, especially in Afghanistan and later in Iraq, which, well, that's another problem, right? But I think it captured something, right? It captured that visceral, like, that reaction, that Bush on the, you know, on the pile saying, you know, we're coming to get you. And it, you know, it captured that kind of, you know, spirit. And then, you know, the Axis of Evil speech, you know, later on, then kind of framed that narrative. It wasn't just that we were attacked, right? It's that there's this evil plot, right? It's not just about 9/11. Now it becomes about Iraq and about, you know, North Korea and so on. And so once you start framing things in that way, I don't think it's that violence is inevitable, but I think it makes it much easier, much more likely, or in the case of warfare, allows people to justify it in their own minds. See, we're the good guys, right? We're Toby Keith, like, courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue is the name of the song. So it's the flag. It's the, and if you, the video is just, like, over the top, and it's got the eagle, and it's the whole, we're going to come literally give you a black eye. right, are the words. I mean, this is a really in, it's not subtle.
Right.
Like, it's really in your face, but it really, like, resonated. And it's not, like, not like my favorite song, but it is my favorite 9/11 song because it's authentic in that way. And it frames the narrative very clearly, I think. And it captured that moment. Right. Whereas the Alan Jackson song, like, Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning or whatever, like, the, it was a nice song, but it didn't really, like, capture it in the same, like, kind of visceral kind of way that the Toby Keith song.
Well, I think that's what things like country music are so good at, this kind of fantasy, like keeping violence and keeping retribution and revenge in a fantasy narrative world versus, I remember during First Desert Storm, the first images before they decided, oh, hey, we've got to really clamp down
on the media
of this imagery, because I remember the picture of, like, they just bulldozed over top pillbox or bunker or whatever, and it was just Iraqi arms sticking up out of the sand. And they were like if you allow that stuff to take things out of the fantasy over into the documentary, you know, it completely changes the type of narrative that you're putting out in the world. And you talk about rhetorical reactivity, that second type of thing of seeing graphic human death. People can't take that at all. Like, they're not even close to being able to take that. They can't even take that with animals.
So then how does that, because I think we've seen more of that with the conflict in Ukraine, right? We've seen some pretty, like, graphic stuff that's sort of more like, and I agree with you, because that was part of the issue with Vietnam, is people were seeing these really graphic pictures, especially the pictures like from Eli or the Napalm Girl. Like, we're seeing these really, really graphic pictures, and there was some of that in World War II, especially in the Pacific theater. So maybe there was a different narrative, but I think in Vietnam you saw those kinds of images. So I'm interested in, even though we're more of a proxy in that in the conflict, we're supporting Ukraine, about the effects of those kinds of pictures, or the chemical attack pictures from Syria in, like, two, was that 2013? 2014. So I'm wondering, because you're right, with the first Gulf War, they were very careful after that, because I was watching on TV. I was a college student at the time, working the night shift to pay for college. And after that, like, the narrative, the pictures were very, it was a very well-produced war.
Right.
I will say, right? And so I'm wondering if, you know, how the in narrative framing, or how from a rhetorician's perspective, you know, things change when we're not the major combatants, right? When, like, with Syria or Ukraine, or, you know, even with Vietnam, we were a combatant, but it was supporting allies. Wondering if that, does that, do you think that shifts things?
Yeah, clearly it goes back to your point about what human beings need to be able to do to perpetrate violence, or to allow violence, not to intercede with violence, is to create it as, keep it as an abstraction.
Right.
As soon as it becomes visceral and personal and immediate, you know, and empathetic, like, you can't not empathize, then people start to step in. It's like the, you know, pictures of the students dead at Kent State.
Right.
You know, it was a perfect shot, because you also had the reaction shot of the friend to tell you exactly how, you know, just powerful this loss was and how wrong. And so for a rhetorician, those type of super penetrative images soaked in emotion, you know, especially the graphic ones, are going to, you know, rise up all those emotions, and they're going to be incredibly powerful in those situations. So you want to, if you're on the other side, you got to keep those out, you know, as much as you can.
Right. Unless they're, so when I taught political violence, when I teach war, we do a lot of movies, we do a lot of film. And so I think unless that is a part of a larger narrative arc where good guys, bad guys, and then there's resolution at the end of 90 minutes and the hero gets the girl, and it reinforces all our notions of masculinity and triumphalism and American exceptionalism. I mean, pick any action movie, like the Rambo movies, all of those kinds of things. Like, there's a pattern to all of those. So I think when those really nasty things are embedded there as the here's why Mel Gibson like goes off the deep end and starts going after these people,
sure.
right? When it's embedded there, then somehow it's like palatable and acceptable. But when it's that, yeah, that Kent State moment or the My Lai pictures or that picture, you know, some of the pictures that come out after the first Gulf War, right, that were censored at the time. And they're really, I mean, they're just visceral, gut-wrenching pictures. You know, I think that it humanizes things and makes things complicated in a way that we don't like. At least my sense is Americans do not like complicated narratives. We like very simple, straightforward, like good guy, bad guy, the Western, you know, kind of narrative, right? So when things start to get messy and fuzzy, like then people are like, well, I don't know. Well, who's the good guy? Bad guy? Like, are we the baddies? Right.
Yes. Well, I just watched season four of The Handmaid's Tale. And they ran into that problem in season four. She had largely escaped the forces of massive evil that had dominated her and destroyed her in many ways. And now she had some efficacy against them, and she was being just as violent, if not more, you know, and
right.
had completely lost her humanity. And so it was hard to root for her, you know,
yeah.
No matter what she had been traumatized by. You're kind of like, yeah, I get it, but.
But there's a line there, right? That doesn't fit with our narrative. Yeah.
So from a philosophy standpoint, like when you bring these things up, I guess you've got the population of the military and then the students. Like what's the difference when you try to teach these things into the military? Like, do you have an agenda with a philosopher that you'd like, where you'd like for people to land up, or are you just trying to teach them the skills, the tools?
Well, it depends on the course. So we have a core course called Leadership in the Profession of Arms, which is a leadership and ethics course. And that's very much about just sort of getting them to think about their own leadership. I teach courses in just war. I teach a moral philosophy course. Right now I'm teaching a moral and ethical failure course. So in those other courses, it's more about sort of the specific content, which is sometimes more philosophical. So then it's about getting them to think about their own philosophical and ethical commitment. But one of the challenges in talking about political violence in the military is that we have this sort of civilian-military relationship where we expect the military to be, quote-unquote, apolitical. But all of your listeners who have read my book know that I think that apolitical stuff's a bunch of BS. And what Huntington should have said, Samuel Huntington, is that what we want is a nonpartisan military, right? Because the military is a political actor, that they act as the agent of the state. So by definition, they're political actors. But what we want is a nonpartisan military. And so I think there's a great sensitivity to talking about anything that seems like political or partisan with something like January 6th. Definitely was, or any of these kinds of issues can be. And so I think the first thing is just to get people comfortable. I know people don't like the term safe space, but I think that's really important to create a rhetorical space where people can examine ideas, can examine their own ideas, can ask questions, can push back, can share arguments, can say, I'm really uncomfortable right now. Examine assumptions, which I spend a lot of time hammering home, so much so that my students get really sick of it. What I think a lot of people, I mean, you can't examine what you can't find. And so the first task is to help them find what are your assumptions? Like, where is this stuff kind of coming from? So I don't know that I have a particular place that I want to get them to be, but it's more of getting them to really dig deep and examine their assumptions and to think about what commitments they have, especially for those people who are members of the military. Some of our students are civilians or from other government agencies. Plus, we have international students from all over the world. So wherever people are coming from, to think about what are the obligations of their profession that they've chosen. These are mid-career people mostly. And to think about those assumptions and to think about where their lines are, you know. So January 6th was a difficult thing for us to talk about, right? It's still a difficult thing to talk about, even a couple of years later, as people are trying to, you know, process these things and figure out what their obligations are. The COVID vaccines have been big discussions. That's not necessarily a political violence question, but that's a question around, you know, what are your obligations to obedience? Which does get to, is there ever a time right. when, you know, as a member of the military, you could use force against your own citizens, or you would, you know, rebel against your own government, those kinds of questions. We don't spend a lot of time on those questions. But I mean, they're also part of American history. We began with a nonviolent rebellion to start with, and then it turned into a violent rebellion. So we were literally birthed, you know, out of political violence. So when people say, well, this isn't America, I'm like, where have you been? Right? Yes, it is. I mean, we could talk about whether the founding fathers were justified and which actions were justified. But, you know, the American Revolution, the Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement, which was nonviolent, at least on one side, was met with violence on the other side. And there were, you know, groups and people who advocated for violence. Thought Martin Luther King Jr. thought the nonviolent approach was not the way to go, right? So this business of political violence is something that is really deep in the American philosophical sort of political tradition, which isn't to say, like, I think it's fabulous, we should all be violent all the time. But this question of where the line is has always been with us.
Yeah, and I think that fluidity, you know, of where it lands to start the discussion on each side and figure out where everybody is on that line. Like the idea of political nonviolence is a rhetorical move. I mean, it's right. political obstructionism, right? Like it's
right.
within the world of politics, it is a violent, aggressive political move to just, we are not going to agree, even though like the laws are this way and everything's set up, we're just not going to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's been turned around now by the right, and then the right is going, oh, hey, we can use that too. You know, like the semis showing up in Canada and
right.
you know, all these very traditional kind of civil righty, you know, techniques and tactics. And they're like, oh, yeah, we'll just use that too. And, you know, obstructionism is clearly, I mean, it's somewhere on that fluid line of violence.
Because it's, I mean, if we think of that as a kind of resistance, right? And whether it's Martin Luther King or Gandhi, right? Where you're literally putting your body or your follower sort of in the path of whatever power is involved, right? And it's a resistance, it's a pushback. And I think, yeah, you're right. I think the line about, so that question that we started with about what's the definition of violence, I think is a really important question. Because if we think about violence as something that has the effect of causing harm, physical or otherwise, clearly physical violence causes harm, but I would argue there are forms of rhetorical violence or obstructionism or resistance that also cause harm. And we know from intimate partner violence, it doesn't have to be physical to be abused. Right. So this question of what constitutes violence and Is it harm, or is it certain kinds of harm that we want to say would constitute violence? Because if I hurt your feelings, is that violence? If you say, wow, that shirt, Pauline, that you're wearing, I don't know what's going on with that, I'd be like, yeah, I just kind of pulled it out of the drawer and yeah, I'm not in love with it either. But that's different than saying, I think your child is like a reprobate and is going to be a juvenile delinquent. He's going to prison. That's a different kind, like, I would consider that more in the realm of violence, and that probably would be met, because I'm sort of the mama grizzly bear type, that probably would be met with violence if you insulted my child, right?
Yeah.
So I think this question about that, you know, I don't think it's a binary. I do think it's a continuum, and it's hard to suss out, like, where are the lines, where are the demarcations?
Well, and you see, you know, one of the big rhetorical moves that's happening now and this is sort of described in postmodernism and late modernism of appropriation, where
right.
you don't have to have the roots of a rhetoric in order to use that rhetoric.
Right.
And so you see this with violence, like the whole terminology of microaggressions. You know, that's essentially saying you are doing something that I'm pulling this term aggression out, and I'm going to use it over here, you know, as a way of labeling your behavior to villainize your behavior a little more than it's been villainized. You know, it used to be hurt my feelings, or that's rude, or whatever. Now it's a microaggression. And if you can get terms like that to stick, they'll do work for you.
Right. You know?
But it's a question of once you try to start doing that in sort of an artificial way, it gets kind of awkward. And this is what happens where it blows back against like the progressive left about woke and all these terms that they've introduced that are lampoonable. And you know, you can turn that back around on them rhetorically fairly easily, because you can see that they just grabbed that term in an artificial way.
Right. Or just take a term like critical race theory and then say, well, this is anything I don't like about a racial conversation. So my question is, like, how do you respond to that if people are, so say I'm from a certain religious tradition, someone sort of takes a term, or I'm a feminist and they take a term, you take it out of the context in which it emerges. And has meaning, because woke has a particular meaning, especially within an African American cultural context, right? Religious context, right? So what's the response when your adversary rhetorically does that to you? Like, how do you, like, I think the response has been, here, let me explain the historical context or the philosophical whatever behind that. And that hasn't worked, right? Because they're using that term pejoratively or in a mocking way, or deliberately sort of representing, now making that term mean something else other than what it originally sort of meant. Sort of like when teenagers take a word that we all like and that now it has a new meaning. I can't think of one right now, so I'm not that hip and try not to speak to my teenager. But like, you know, when you take a term from one context and move it to another and appropriate it, like, what's the response to that?
Well, as you're talking about this, I realized like one of the reasons why I named my book 21 Colosseums of Persuasion is because a Colosseum is a theater of battle.
That's right. Yeah.
It's made for violence, right? And essentially what happens in that situation, I talk about, you know, Aristotle's definition is basically, you know, a rhetorician needs to be able to see the whole menu, every mm-hmm. possible option, and choose the right one.
Right.
So I try to lay out the whole menu in there. And like a lot of times when people ask me things like that, like what rhetorical work can you do to grab that back, or what happens when that in that definitional, you know, fluidity situation, it's the right tends to do ethos work on terms. They just slander them.
Right.
They use them pejoratively. They don't do logos work at all. Whereas right. the left will come back up and go, but that's not the definition, which is all logos work. And I'm like, you're in the right. wrong Colosseum. Like,
right.
You need to go back over here and valorize CRT if you're going to, you know, fight that war over that term. And it has to be done very specifically, because they have it's a very clean agenda to stain something. Out of all the things that percolate,
right.
one will suddenly
to slur
get cleanable.
It's to say this is now an insult. So woke is now an insult, right? Or, you know, whatever the, you know, feminine, oh, you're a feminist. Like, that's an insult,
right?
Right? Even though, like, I'm like, sure.
Sure, why not? Yeah,
That's an accurate description of my philosophical worldview, and your point is what. But yeah, I think, you know, yeah, they are, you know, are engaged in, and maybe that's part of our not the problem, but the feature of our discourse right now, is that we're actually engaged in different discourses at the same time. We're not actually like talking to each other. I don't know that we're talking past each other, but we're engaged in different language games, is what Wittgenstein would call.
Yeah.
Right.
I call it rhetoric storms. It's just different rhetoric storms coming at each
yeah.
other. If you don't match their storm, you're never going to get into their head. You're never going to get into their herd and make any progress. So
does that make violence more likely? Because if I see that my rhetoric is not, I'm not able to engage, I'm not able to persuade my colleagues to take my definition of this word seriously, or say, okay, I am a feminist, let's talk about what that means and what you disagree with me on. If that person is just not willing to engage, does that make violence more likely?
Well, again, I think that's one of the reasons I like rhetoric so much, is that the menu never ends. Like,
okay.
Violence down here, physical. So, like, in the world of influence, here's like the options, but you still have to put physical control and physical attack somewhere in that world, because
right.
it is inextricable from super frustration, or, you know, not being able to have any efficacy in a situation where suddenly, like, you see all these movies about the righteous, like the dad who shoots the convict who, you know, molested his daughter because he can't.
Right. He can't, you know, do anything else, right? Everything else
in the
failed.
Word systems, the institutions are failing. So at some point, violence is always hovering right here in these discussions. So I think it is one of those things that, as long as it's an option, as opposed to something that gets locked out, as I don't care how frustrated you get, we will never sanction violence here. You know, like,
yes.
If you go back to country music, one of my favorite songs is Before He Cheats.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah. Violence against the guy's truck. It's like, oh,
right,
man,
I'm take out
the guy's truck.
Like, that's cold. And country music, like, I have a truck, I'm from Montana. That is cold. Like maybe violence against his dog or his horse is worse, but the truck is like, it's
right.
Really serious.
I mean, it was an automotive boiling of a bunny, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's a good. So in just war theory, when we're thinking about political violence in the context of warfare, we would normally say, listen, violence, warfare needs to be a last resort. You need to have tried other things first. You have to have a just cause. You have to fulfill certain criteria. It has to be a public act, all of these kinds of things. But this idea of last resort, and also you have to have a reasonable chance of success, which I think our current sort of political discourse, I've been thinking about whether it was the attack on the FBI office, I think that was in Ohio, or January 6th, or these other or mass shootings. I do wonder about, so very often it does seem like to the people perpetrating them, this is last resort, right? But I also wonder about reasonable chance of success, because one of the criteria is supposed to be reasonable chance of success. Now, we can have a talk with Vladimir Putin about how he calculated that there was a reasonable chance of success in Ukraine, but that's a different problem. But I wonder, in terms of this political violence that we see, whether that's mass shootings, which seem to me often are a form of political violence, or January 6th, or, you know, these, you know, attacks like against the FBI. I wonder if people are, does reasonable chance of success matter at that point? Is that just, I've run out of options, it doesn't matter if I succeed or not?
I think, again, it's that oscillating definition of success, right?
Okay.
I had a guy on here a couple of weeks ago who had published a blog post in 2018 called "I Was Almost a School Shooter."
Okay.
And he was talking about the psychological experience of, you know, growing up in a horrific environment and going down so far where the only thing he could see to do was basically go out in a blaze of proof. Like, you think I'm this bad, I'm going to show you how bad I can be. So his criteria of success wasn't to overcome the enemy. It was a bigger sense of identity, you know, and fighting back against this invisible enemy of repressive culture that doesn't see him and things like that. So I think that the success button moves around a lot in that definition.
Yeah, and I think when we see like incel violence, right, against women in particular, that success seems to be, I want attention, I want to prove that these women were wrong about me, and I want to visit harm on these women. So success, so the extent to which you've killed or hurt people is success in itself. And then you add the identity piece to it, which I think is increasingly, my sense is that's increasingly more and more salient as a part of success, right? That this is, I am showing them, because I think so many people, despite, this is really weird because we all have social media, we all have video, we can TikTok and show everyone the most intimate details of our life, whether they want to see it or not, right? And yet we don't feel seen and we don't feel heard. And so some of these actions are clearly, and you know, when I was dealing with toddlers, we would call this attention seeking behavior, right?
Sure.
You're throwing a tantrum in the middle of the floor because you didn't get your way is what, you know, is what that is. Or my teenager slamming his door when he's mad at me, right? It's attention seeking behavior because I don't see, I don't feel seen and heard, which I think for some people means I'm not validated. You don't approve of me. You don't like me. So it's not just being seen and heard. It's being seen and heard in the sense of validation and adulation and, yeah, and fame. And you think I'm wonderful, right? So yeah. I think, yeah, it strikes me that identity piece maybe is a bigger piece of the political violence issue than maybe it has been in the past.
Right? Well, and I think, you know, the social media stuff, you see a lot of, social media is this weird mix of public and private, right? Like it's never really been, it's never been close to being this available to everybody to have, right, access to a public character, the public space. Yeah. And the challenge becomes everybody starts entering that space and now it becomes competitive again for like who can actually get any attention. Even the 4th of July shooter in Illinois, he had posted tons of, you know, videos of himself. He had tried to be an influencer in this space and got nothing, you know, got no response at all. And so I think that sense of disempowerment, you know, that can lead to violence, you know, this idea of I'm so disempowered, I've got to do something extreme, and, you know, buying a gun and committing a high profile act of violence is going to rocket you up into the, you know, social consciousness, without a doubt.
How do we sort out the role that capitalism has in that, right? Because the social media platforms, yeah, it is about getting likes and getting attention, but then there's also money that comes from that. The reason why all this, you know, I saw, you know, some statistics about 1 in 4 Gen Zers wants to be a social media influencer. And I'm like, of course they do, because that's how you make money, right? Sure. It's a good, you know, they probably make more than I do. So that's like, I should mention that to my teenager and say, you know, maybe this would be a good job prospect for you. So I wonder about the intersection, because there's sort of the intangible incentives, right, of getting attention and getting fame and getting likes and that. But that's also, that's tied to monetary, you know, money and sort of capitalistic considerations too.
Well, the guy who wore the bison head, you know, on January 6th was an
right
athlete, right? And he got more, yeah, attention from that. I don't think he monetized it. Maybe he did. But he got more attention from that violent, participating in that overall violence, you know, and being prepared for it as a performer, like a, right, an influencer. Like he knew, like, I need a real costume. That guy was an actor and he had the, you know, everything.
He right, worked it too. Like it was a whole vibe, right? And so it was a convincing, interesting performance that becomes part of the narrative, right?
Well, and he gets swept up into the villain narrative. Was he really a villain? He was an actor. Did he really do anything violent other than walk in there amongst all the other violence? You know, and so like you get this weird kind of, is this actual violence, you know, versus faux violence, like you're talking about in the movies and things like that, where you get this satisfying conclusion, because we not only kill, like on Handmaid's Tale, they killed one of the main characters at the end of season 4, one of the main villains. And it was like all the handmaids sort of, it was this very stylistic way of killing him out in the woods and like 20 women just pounding on him, but they didn't show it. They
right,
didn't show him the way they usually do. If a man kills a man, they'll show like the, you know, all
blood
the
spurting, blood, yeah, face,
body parts,
yeah,
everything.
Yeah.
But they didn't show it, which is typically what they do in the movies. They don't show direct female, you know, hyperviolence against females, and apparently not so much
by females. Right. Yeah. So I wonder about the role of intent here, because I was thinking about the guy who testified in the January 6th hearings, and he was from Ohio or wherever. And like all of us, like watching that guy, like we all know somebody like that. Right. Especially those of us who grew up in the Midwest, right? We all, like, he's in our family somewhere. And it was just interesting, like, it's not like some people, like the Oath Keeper people, clearly set out to engage in violence, and they had a plan, and they had resources, and they were ready to go. But it seems like other people got swept up in it, and it was almost like sort of cosplaying, right?
Yep.
It was just like you're at one of those conventions, and this is just like a fun thing you're doing for the weekend with the guys or the girls, and like somewhat performance, somewhat karaoke, somewhat I don't know, you know, like Dungeons and Dragons or something like that, you know, those kinds of things, right? Just struck me in that way. And then they got sort of caught up and actually with real violence, and then sort of when people started being held to account, and you could hear it in this guy's testimony, like he almost seemed shocked that he got in trouble for this, right? Which I think to some degree, maybe it speaks to, you know, impunity and privilege, but it also maybe just speaks to that at least some of the people didn't have the intent to violence, or hadn't conceptualized it in that way. When Trump says, let's march, let's go to the Capitol, I'm going to be with you. Like, did they see that? Did they think, okay, we're going to go be violent? Or did they think, listen, we're just going to go support the president? And they maybe hadn't thought through like what was actually going to happen when they got there, right? Because I wonder about that, because it seems like there's different, like there were clearly people who were locked and loaded and prepared for what we think of as straightforward political violence, rebellion, the, you know, warfare, the whole thing. But then it seemed like there were other people that were like, some of them were there for the party, some of them were there because they were expressing their political frustration that the election didn't turn out for their guy in the way that they hoped that it would. Some of them were there out of loyalty to Trump and the sort of cult of personality stuff. So seems like there's a lot of different things going on, and you know, intent gets murky, I think, really fast. Like,
right. Well, as per always in these complex environments, there are multiple motives. Like, this is one of the things rhetoric likes to play with. What is the motive? What is the actual words, you know, that used? How do you work between those two things? I think it's interesting, like January 6th becomes, in the January 6th hearings, they have to amplify the villainy. They have to amplify the violence, and they've shown time-lapse photo, you know, video, and they've done anything they can to amplify, bring in the victims, direct victims of the violence of the, like the, you know, the police officers, and have them testify and show the things that have happened to them, because they've got to keep that high. They've got to keep that this was a massively violent event. And because so few people, you know, died, like within the context of how many people were actually there and what was happening.
Yeah.
It's not violent enough for, you know, that argument on that side of the rhetoric. And on the other side, it's these people were just wandering in the Capitol to have a discussion.
Hanging out.
Violence, you know?
It was a party. Like, they just, you know, they were pub crawling.
They got a little
and they ended up, in the cap and they ended up, yeah, so I think that's interesting. The commission, January 6th commission, I think has been really interesting, because they clearly, like, in terms of rhetoric, I mean, this is clearly like a made for TV thing, and people are talking about it in terms of like what's going to happen next season, which is not usually how people talk about congressional hearings.
Right.
And so that's been really interesting. I expected them to be quite boring, like congressional hearings usually are, which I enjoy, like, because I do my grading or other things while I'm watching them. But it was especially Ms. Hutchinson, her testimony, like, it was riveting. Like, it was like watching like Days of Our Lives or Perry Mason or something. And I know all that was very, very kind of intentional, right? Because of what the narrative arc of of what they're trying to do. But you're right. There's a sense in which, though, there's a sense in which the violence is part of the narrative, but that's actually not the most. That's not in the narrative. That's not the most shocking thing, right? So they have to figure out how do you portray the thing that's the most shocking to an audience that's used to visual violence, is accustomed to visual violence, and that's the shock factor. And how do you get people's attention when someone's just like sitting there in a suit testifying? So that's a really interesting sort of rhetorical performance problem, which I've done. I mean, it was, you know, some of the hearings were quite compelling TV, I will say.
Violence is definitely a strong political football. Like, if you can label your other side with it, and it's violence against the wrong people, then you get a lot of traction, versus violence against the right people, you get a lot of traction. So this idea that we're sending, you know, Biden is sending these advanced weapons kind of on the down low, Reagan, you know, esque, to Ukraine, who's the good guy in this fight. And therefore, you know, Russia hasn't had the success that it's supposed to have had there because of this, you know, kind of below the table amping of their violent capacity, because they're the, you know, the good guys in this. And so the more we supply them, the better we are as a country. Maybe we're leading to that, you know, Russia to up its game to the point where they're really going to destroy Ukraine instead of do what they would have done, which is maybe kill off some, you know, areas and then annex
part of it. Yeah, that was an interesting, speaking of rhetoric, that was an interesting sort of lead up, because I was at a military ethics conference actually the week before the invasion, or a few days. I walk into my hotel room after giving my paper talking about my book, and walked in there, and the Chiron is like, you know, Putin's invaded. And I was like, and everyone was talking about it beforehand, and I was getting ready to teach when I got back to start teaching strategy and policy, which is one of our core courses at the War College, and really didn't need another case study. But it was one of those things where I was like, no, he didn't invade, because that's like so very like 20th century, we don't do that anymore. And so that the rhetoric and the framing of all of that, especially leading up, and then when he actually did invade, it was like, oh, okay, what do we do now? Because like, that's not the narrative that we had set up. We had this set up as this, like, it was this negotiating ploy and chess move. And as a just war theorist, I was like, nah, he's manipulating. This is a chess move. He's never going to do this. And I'm standing there looking at the TV going, dang, okay. So what do I do with my military ethics class that I have to teach, and my strategy and policy class, where we actually had and knew we were going to have a student from Ukraine in the class, right? So that you have to rethink the approach to things. But yeah, so that was very interesting. It was also interesting watching the media have to, like, after the narrative sort of had been set, and all the pundits had been saying this, and then all of a sudden, like, things are rolling and people are like, ooh.
Ooh, real violence. Look at that.
Ooh. So we have to, like, and it was just interesting having to watch, you know, all of the media outlets try to, like, so what do you do rhetorically when, like, the facts in your face all of a sudden don't fit the narrative that you've, like, set up? And I remember watching, on 9/11, watching that second plane going to the building, going, this is not happening. No, this is not happening. This can't be happening, right?
Right.
Even though, like, I remember the prior attack, you know, terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, you know, years earlier, and, you know, Oklahoma City. So it's not like we didn't have stuff like this happening. But I just remember looking at the second plane going, this can't be happening. Like, this is a movie. Like, what is this, right? And as a young military ethicist, I was like, oh boy, like, what? Yeah, so for me that's sort of an interesting thing to think about.
It speaks to this weird core confusion rhetorically that we all deal with these days of growing up in the simulacrum culture, right? We're used to things being brought to us in a simulated fashion. And when reality comes, we think they're based in reality. There's some version of reality that they capture and they're bringing to us. But then you see reality invade what the structure that they've just created. I think it's like the slap at the Oscars, you know, with Chris Rock.
Oh, yeah, that was something,
which
right?
To me was such a fascinating moment because you're seeing this interplay of entertainment and reality, you know, reality journalism, TV, that we've never had before. It's gotten way more complex. And Trump, you know, rode in on those twin surfboards of the confusion inside of that. And people are still confused. They still deem him a hero, even though in reality world, he's done none of the things that would, you know, deserve the accolade of hero. He's got more,
right,
more failure than he has, you know, success. And Americans would never say a failure is going to be that kind of hero. But there's this core confusion. And like that moment when Will Smith slapped Chris Rock, a billion people went, is that a bit?
I thought it was, because I was, and someone sent me the video. They're like, did you just see this? And I thought it was a bit. Yeah, I thought it was part of the act or part of like a joke or something. And then and then you started replaying it. I was like, I think he was, so did he actually just, and that's not something, at least, you know, and they did talk a lot about different sort of cultural contexts, but unless you hang out in, you know, bars on a Friday night in Montana, you're not we don't see people just walk up and slap other people, right? That's not something that most Americans have as a part of their experience, except as a part of entertainment. So our narrative was like, well, okay, this has to be part of the bit,
right?
Because it can't be the real thing. And besides, this is the Oscars and everyone's dressed up and presumably
the elite
people behave themselves like you're on TV, your mom's watching this.
They can't possibly be animalistic.
Right. Know? Yeah. So like it was Friday night, the JBRT in Great Falls, Montana, and the Cowboys are drunk. We might say, oh yeah, like, okay, that could happen. But that's not what you expect to see when you turn on the Oscars.
Yeah, so it was this weird royal of reality and entertainment and confusion and, you know, trying to find some location to go, how do I interpret this? You know, and how bad was this? And he hit him really hard.
And Chris was like, you know, you could tell he was rocked back. Is part of that, I wonder, with Trump, because he was a reality star. Like, so he was this kind of 80s icon, but he was like a kitschy 80s icon, I remember, because I lived in the 80s. And then he becomes this reality star. And then when he's like running for president, I just wonder if we've become so accustomed to reality TV shows that sometimes we can't tell the difference. Like, I think people just thought he was running as a ploy. And then when he's actually elected, people are like, oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah,
does
it's that
thing
for confusion. And, you know, you pointed to the January 6th hearings being produced by television producers. So there's actual drama in there. There's pluckable moments that can be reused in social media, like the Josh Hawley running, you know, video. It's a beautiful troll moment.
That was lovely.
You know? But all that, all that's designed out for that simulated medium so that it can depopulate through the whole ecology. But Trump, you know, he was the first person to come in and use reality plot lines in politics, like straight up just attack three or four different people like every day and never let it settle, never go back to it. It doesn't matter. As soon as it loses energy, pick somebody else. And if you watch The Real Housewives or whatever, they have running feuds, but they they're just rude to everybody. It's just all over the place. And that reality show plot line of I just need to cause trouble, you know, has been the macro technique for Trump all along. I think when you run it, I always said what was going to be interesting to me, because like fascism 2.0 essentially hides no bodies on the ground. Like, to me, the only real difference between fascism 1.0 and 2.0 right now is that they're not leaving bodies. They're using rubber bullets instead of real bullets. You know, so you're not seeing that kind of visceral, you know, effects of the violence that they're doing. you know, go after BLM and go after these, you know, what they would want to use as villain moments of the
right.
left. But as soon as they stop dropping bodies, then the whole thing changes. The narrative changes. And they work really hard not to do that.
Yeah, because that produces a particular effect when that starts to happen. And as long as it's so that's back to that, the threshold of violence, right? And what kind of will we tolerate? So we are acclimated to reality TV. So I think we are used to this constant like shock factor, and not just reality TV, but like the, you know, Jerry Springer and all those like talk shows and TV shows where people are working out their family problems on TV and all of that. So I think we're acclimated to that constant churn, that constant drama to a certain extent, but not when someone punches someone else who's in a tuxedo or, you know, wants it. I mean, I do like, there was something about January 6th because I had just, we were, it was in the middle of COVID. And I'd been teaching my leadership and profession of arms class that morning and had come off Zoom and had come into the living room and I'd left the TV on. And I got a text from my other son who's on the West Coast. And he's like, Mom, are you watching this on TV? And I was like, oh, I just walked in. He's like, what's going on? He's like, you're the professor. You explain this to me. And I'm like, I don't know what's going on. What the heck is going on? It looks like they're like storming the Capitol. What is this, Bastille Day or something? Like, it just was one of those things where you're like, weird, like, what is this? Like, and you're sitting down watching this and we're all watching this together going, what the heck is going on? And so that was one of those moments too, because it was that reality, you know, sort of coming into what like didn't right. seem to fit.
Well,
right?
And, you know, you go back to fit. You pull in things like, and this is a little more abstract for Americans, even though they got to hear the audio and things like that, but the Khashoggi, you know, murder, you know.
Okay, yeah.
And the fact that we were kind of involved in that, right? He was a naturalized citizen here? Can't remember.
I forget, but I mean, he worked for the Washington Post,
right? So I don't remember if he was a naturalized citizen or not, but it was close to being an American, what somebody could see as a full American,
right,
being murdered by a foreign entity that just didn't like his what he was saying.
Reporting, yeah.
And we got to hear a little bit of that audio, and Trump literally going his final response of, "Hey, it's a, you know, it's a bad world out there, a lot of bad people." Like, and that just closed, that just tied it off, and you're like, "That's enough for us to see a murder out in the open and move it over into, well, that's just part of doing business.
Shit happens."
That's amazing that you can say that, you know, and get away with it as a rhetorical strategy.
So as a rhetorician, what did you think of the impact of the video of George Floyd being murdered? Because that's not, like, we've seen stuff kind of like that before, but maybe not that graphically, or I just think that was an interesting, it was a weird moment in my house because one of my sons is African-American. So that was a whole different conversation, right? But that was interesting that moment seemed to, like, it kind of reminded me of the Rodney King beating in the 90s,
right?
Except I think it had a much more, I mean, that had a galvanizing effect too, but like this was like, it had a particular effect that the things like that had happened before. I mean, didn't seem to have quite the same effect unless you think about like Ferguson, but.
Yeah, I mean, that fully raw, high def, almost choreographed to the point, and just the time spent watching this happen. It wasn't like a punch, you know, the thing, Arkansas police came out last week.
Yeah.
The police are always getting these and it looks horrible. And violence like that is constantly available now. You've seen the verbal violence, like the Karens going off with full racism, you know, blaring and things like that. But that video was so high def and so, you know, long, you know, and
yeah.
You watch the guy die underneath this guy's leg. There's never been anything like that as far as a rhetorical artifact that I know of.
Yeah, I think it was the time, and I think it was Dave Chappelle, his routine afterwards, where he was just talking about like that the time becomes a sort of emblematic thing, and in several of the services they talked about the time, and so that was an interesting piece. But you're right, yeah, for that kind of a thing, it was long, right? And it was, yeah, and the high def and the, and I think for many people not from a marginalized community, like this may have, I mean, they may have seen these short videos on the news before, but this seemed to be a different kind of thing. And that, like, what got me is that he was calling for his mother, right? And that was, as a mom, that just got me. So, but yeah, that was a really interesting moment. And I think the context of the pandemic, too, probably because we were all stuck at home. Right, we're mostly stuck at home. We were in a different space than, you know, we weren't going to work, we weren't doing on vacation doing the things that we would have been doing. Yeah.
Yeah, and on my side of the world, it's always the sort of agnostic rhetorician looking for assets. You know, what does this message or this symbol or this video do for my side? How does it hurt the other side? How do I respond if it's hurting me on my side? And you see things like this in the sort of vegan wars with what essentially are horror films
Yeah.
of people, of animals being murdered. You know, and they shoot them like horror films. The bodies flop, blood splatters, and all these things where that type of visceral use of video and death and this kind of, you know, sort of bland cruelty that people have about, they don't even care. It's just another dead
Right.
thing that they're processing. And those are hard to overcome, you know, rhetorically. I think what happens typically is that the more you see that, it's somehow the human response to, you know, start to find a way to compartmentalize it, move it down in the emotional order so that you're not constantly feeling this massive triggering. And
Right.
so, you know, people try to get away from it. They stop watching that stuff as much. I would bet even with the Ukraine stuff, people are not watching that hardly at all anymore.
No, and I think originally, like, sort of people were riveted, and maybe not in a, and I know, like, there, a week into the war, people were like, okay, what's gonna happen next? Like, it was like they were watching a TV show, and it was like, y'all, this is like the real thing. And so that's always, that just kind of struck me about how acclimated we are because of reality TV and because of social media and popular media. We're so you know, acclimated to things getting sorted out in a half an hour, 90 minutes, 2 hours max, and you know, a certain kind of narrative arc and all this kind of thing. And so when something disrupts that expectation, then that's interesting. I think we struggle to kind of deal with that, which I think has been part of, you know, 20 years of conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. Like, Americans don't have that kind of attention span. We didn't with Vietnam either, right? So it's like, how do you keep that the
Well,
focus, and how do you keep people's attention when you're dealing with things like that over that period of time?
this is also part of your issues. Like there's just so much violence in the world. If you start
Yeah.
going poaching it from its different locations, like you said, all the way down into relationships, parental violence, school violence, every it's so permeated that people, again, like no matter what you use, if you overuse rhetorical assets, it's going to start lose power. You
Yeah.
know, it's got trigger power, but then it becomes exhaustion and people just have to stay away from you. I'm curious, like when you do this in your classes, is there a sense of, I mean, must be hard to teach within the context of you're teaching people who are essentially being trained how to do violence well. You know, and they're supposed to make good choices about it. It's supposed to have its borders and parameters. But do you feel like, and is it a neutered space as an academic or an educator where you're like, again, like I'm just trying to get you guys into this space where you can be critical about all this? Or is it like, you know, like you said, feminist and mom and things like that? When you bring in artifacts to talk about, do you take a position? Do they want, do they allow you to do that, like the students, to, you know, be you for real? Or are you, you know, doing this as an academic straight up?
Well, again, it depends on the class, right? So, but I do tend to have a teaching style where, you know, I will say, as a philosopher, my job is to question your assumptions and to pose arguments and this kind of thing. So I like to be sort of somewhat unpredictable. But around things where I'm writing and I have scholarship, I will tell them, here's what I'm thinking. Tell me what's wrong with this, or what have you. In terms of the violence piece, the kinds of, I mean, not all my students have seen combat, first of all. So I would say maybe 50, 60%, right? So that's one piece. The other piece is that they come having been in a deployment operational cycle where they don't have a chance to catch their breath because of the operational tempo that our military and, you know, CIA and these government agencies are under, right? State Department. And so this, their time at the War College is a chance to take a breath and to reflect on their experiences. So a lot of my students want to take a breath, and they want to, they've been through some stuff and they want to think about it. So last year, the first day of leadership and profession of arms was the Monday after we withdrew from Afghanistan. And I walked in, the first lesson for leadership and profession of arms is on the profession of arms. And we had just, you know, what are the moral obligations of the profession we just pulled out of Afghanistan? And we were basically processing moral injury first day of class as we were going. Right, because we had students who, you know, had been there, still had connections, were trying to get people out. So, like, sometimes there's that kind of craziness, but the students in general, I think they understand their War College time is a time to step back and think about some of this stuff that they've been through, that they've experienced, but they haven't had a chance to process. They haven't had a chance to think about, what does this mean? So then it's more about them and less about me. So I'm more of a cat herder, and trying to facilitate conversation, which I think is in the Socratic spirit, even if that's not how Socrates actually rolled, right? That my job is to set up some guardrails, to pose some questions, and then to kind of see where things go, and they don't always go where I think they're going to go. And that's fine, because the point is the discussion and their conversations with each other too, because they're peers, right?
Right.
In a significant way that a classroom at an undergraduate institution where you got freshmen and seniors and different majors in the same room, they're kind of peers, but not in the same way that, so my leadership profession of arms, I teach the senior class. They're all at the same level, right? Different, it's joint, so they're, you know, Marines and Navy and Army and civilians, but they're at the same sort of level of their careers, right? So it's also, the conversation is about their conversation with each other, and I'm just kind of there to poke and guide. And there are times when, like, discussion's going one way and I'm like, have you thought about this, or when I want to push back a little bit, but sometimes I also just have questions, since this is what I do for a living, research military ethics. So it's a good chance to just have conversations with people who've been there and done that, which obviously I haven't. So it kind of depends on the context, but they bring a lot of experience to the room. So part of the syllabus is them processing that experience, them thinking about their experience of their career so far and where they're going next, and whatever crazy stuff's happening out in the world.
That's always been my favorite academic space, is that sort of the creating academic space for adults. Mm-hmm. Who are not processing, oh, I'll be in this career or I'll do this someday, but it's, I just got through doing all this, and yeah, I would have been great if I'd have known this stuff then.
Yeah, exactly. It's a, you know, it's a fun job. But it's, there are days, like last year, after the Afghanistan withdrawal, I was really glad that I did work on moral injury, and I could sort of navigate that. Some of my colleagues did not have that background, and it was a challenge. Or, you know, after the week after January 6th, going back to that LPA class and saying, okay, let's talk about civ-mil relations and the moral obligations of the profession, and let's try to process this weird thing that's happening in our international life. So, but it's also about understanding, I think, you know, like your conversations, sometimes it's a learning moment, a teaching moment. And it's important, I think, to take on those tough conversations. So my class this week, we got into some stuff on, you know, identity and race and gender. And, you know, one of the students remarked that on each other's faces they saw excitement for some people and sheer terror from other people, and I was like, that's what we do here, right? But it's creating that space where, okay, that question came up, let's go for it. But that also requires, as you know, some expertise, right, and some practice, right, and some skills to make sure that's not an abusive situation, and that it actually becomes a learning moment.
Well, it was fascinating when my one experience at the Naval War College 25 years ago or so, when they brought me in to do a seminar, because I was the only comedian rhetorician they could find for the Strategic Studies Institute, which I don't think is around anymore. But the day, you know, spending a day with those guys and all the different commanders that they had brought in from different branches, and realizing like what it finally boiled down to was a discussion of, is it possible basically to drop words on people instead of bombs? You know, like how much work can you do with really well-designed rhetoric versus having to go in and use violence? You know, and maybe they work in tandem. You know,
yeah.
Many times it's like, oh, we are going to continue to do this unless you know, and you find a lot of that interplay with threat and promise of cessation, and you know, all these things that rhetoric gets involved in with the military and with violence. And it was a super fun day talking to them about that.
Yeah, this week, one of the things that was coming up a lot for the leadership class was students thinking about communication generally, like, and how they communicate with their peers and how they're going to communicate with the people that they lead, especially sort of much younger people, so Gen Z and people even younger. So this idea of communication, and that communication is an important part of what they're doing and what they will be doing as a leadership skill, is it was interesting. I mean, it's something that sort of comes up usually, but it, for some reason this year, really came up really early, and really a lot of them are struggling with that and trying to think about what does communication look like, you know, with social media, with political polarization, all of these things going on, and the generational shifts. They, you know, think there's an awareness of that too. So absolutely interesting.
Well, cool. I knew it'd be another fun discussion. It was an hour and 25 minutes like that.
Yeah, I know it goes too fast, but thank you so much. And thank you for letting me ask you questions.
I think we both like to talk about the things we find interesting. So
yeah, very cool. So appreciate the time, and good luck with your work. I think it's important work, engaging people in dialogue. And
well, that's all you can really do eventually, right? Like you said, give them the tools, hope they use them, heighten them, and apply them in ways that make things better. You know, that would be the best outcome.
That would be the hope, but it's like gardening. You plant seeds, pull out some weeds, and you never know what's gonna bloom. And I get emails from my former undergraduates all the time, and it's never the students that you think you would be getting letters from. Like, didn't have you pegged for this, which is great. You know, right. It just goes to show that you don't have control. And so you just have to do the best you can and, you know, water the garden and tend the garden and see what blooms and hope at the end of the day, it's good stuff.
Well, any place people can go and buy your books, any place you want to send them, or to your blog, or
Just yeah, send some to my blog or the On Obedience book, because I could always use more shoes, which is on Amazon, or the U.S. Naval Institute press site. But either of those things would be lovely.
Awesome. Well,
thanks.
Thanks again for popping on.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime. And yeah, we'll see you around.
Okay. That has been the Rhetoric of Violence. Get out there and persuade some people. As always, they need it.